Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Today it's a pleasure to welcome back to the studios of CBS Interactive PhD Strategy Director Chris Stevenson.
Hello, Tim.
And of course, Mumbrella Deputy Editor Robin Hicks.
Hi, Tim.
This week, shake, rattle and roll at Fairfax. Attack of the Moths, a warning from Earth Hour. Lifting content and the Today Tonight, a current affairs saga. 6 p.m. Sorry, make that 6:30 p.m. with George Negus. Winners and losers at 7 and 9.
The pigeons called. They want their lunch back.
And KFC's Cat Among the Pigeons. Now, Chris Stevenson, a podcast regular, welcome back.
Good to be here, Tim.
What's been going on in the world of PhD since we last spoke?
Well, the last time I was in, it was the big one, Unilever, was
you were
imminent.
Waiting to hear, yeah. Weren't you? You'd already pitched. It was
pitched.
You versus Mindshare versus, I forget, was it Initiative or UM, the third one? It was Initiative, wasn't it? Because I think it had been with
yes,
UM before.
Yes, it was. It was the other way around. Yeah, so.
Didn't go your way.
It didn't. But as I said at the time, an amazing journey for us. And it was just brilliant for us to be having those conversations with such a brilliant advertiser. And at 2 years old, just great for us to have those conversations. And didn't go our way, but that's not to say that we, as an agency, didn't benefit and gain and really enjoy the experience.
What's it like, though, the day you kind of get the news that someone else has got it? It must still be a bit kind of flat.
It's really hard. It's hard not to be personal about it. It's hard not, when you've lived with something for that long, for it not to be a personal thing. And I think when you've been doing this job a while, when you've been in this industry a while, you learn to understand that it's okay for those boundaries to be crossed, and you learn to observe that, and then you let it go. But it is tough. It is tough when you get the news. But I think that the challenge is to understand that you've learned a lot as individuals, as an agency, as an organization. There's a lot of knowledge that comes with doing that, and you're defined by your response to it, not by the news.
And presumably, like, for you as sort of one of the leaders of the company, you can't walk around kind of moping. You've actually got to lift the team up.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's about your response to that news, not the news itself. And I think that it's important as leaders in any organization that you set the tone for that, and you lead by example of that, and you're positive and you're optimistic, and you help communicate the fact that a lot was learned, and we're a better agency for that experience.
The other issue. Oh, sorry, go on, Robin.
If you could do the pitch again, was there anything you'd do differently?
I think there are always things you do differently. I think there are always those crucial moments that you look back on. But that's the benefit of hindsight. You simply do not know. It's we'll come to talk about it, but it's about like million dollar drop. You know, you get like there's these 8 critical moments over the course of the pitch, and you don't know until after, you know, that you're going to play exactly right. All you can do is put your best foot forward in those occasions and do what you think is right. I think that certainly one of the lessons for me is that you can never not do enough. On something like that, you've got to take an expectation of 100%, and then you've got to double it.
At every single point,
you've got to deliver and achieve more than anyone is expecting.
The other challenge, I guess, is you've grown quite fast anyway. It would have been a big glass of water to just take on and absorb and carry on servicing clients and all of those things as well.
Yeah, I mean, even for an agency that's grown as much as we have and has changed as much as we have over the last 2 years, it would have marked really unprecedented change for the agency. And we'd have been up for that, and we were 100% up for that, and we were prepared for that. But none of us were pretending that was going to be an easy ride, and it would have been a huge effort. But all this means is that effort and that energy now goes to other things.
To your existing clients. You have had a couple of wins, I think, since we last spoke.
Definitely, yes. Yeah. So since then, and that experience really opened a lot of doors for us, and it opened a lot of conversations. So since then, Gumtree's on board, which is brilliant.
That's
classified online buying and
now
buying
they're
and selling.
Owned by, and I always
they're
get
part
a bit
of the
confused.
eBay group.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And you also
and
really
we also
work
with
eBay.
So now some great conversations and some great relationships now with Gumtree and that wider group as a whole, which we love and enjoy having, and we love working with them.
And a kind of quirky brand, because I think the kind of the snobs, and I probably count myself in there, UFC, Ultimate Fighting Championship, is another win. I've heard some people try to make the argument, actually, if you're going to look at the wrestling brands, this is the white-collar wrestling brand. Is that fair? How would you kind of characterize it?
I think it's clearly a brand with an audience, phenomenally successful in other parts of the world, and and over here it's seen a phenomenal amount of success very quickly. So it's a brand with an audience. It's a brand with a great product, and we're really excited to be working with
them. But with a relatively upmarket audience as well, or that's the argument they make.
Yeah, I think that we have a tendency, I think, as humans and as planners, to pigeonhole things and box things. The reality is that all of these sports and all of these offerings have got a wide range of audiences for a whole variety of different reasons.
I know this is a sales pitch, but when I was talking to someone at UFC Magazine, which is done by ACP, and they'd had really strong pre-sales, someone at ACP was trying to make the argument to me that, you know, it's massively upmarket. You know, if James Packer was to go to a fight, it would be UFC he went to, sort of thing. Is that a fair observation?
That may very well be an observation. I can't comment on what James Packer's choice of male fighting is. Other people are probably more qualified than me to talk about that.
Now, I suppose the other certainly global controversy, and it's probably more controversial in the UK, and I don't know the US than here, was, and there must be a kinder way than putting it in the Evil Babies video, but we did talk about it on the podcast with whoever our guest was that week. This was a video put together by PhD, We Are the Future. It was kind of a bunch of really creepy midwitch cuckoo kids talking about what they were going to be like as consumers in the future. It did get a bit of a backlash, really, didn't it?
It did. It got an incredible reaction. It got a phenomenal reaction globally, but especially in the UK, I think. And we've learned a lot as an organisation from doing it.
So for those who aren't familiar with the video, maybe take us right back and tell us what the thinking behind it
was. Yeah, so it originated as a contribution for a TED project, a TED competition, which is provocative points of view on media and communications and how they're changing. And that was the context for it. And so we created a video which was really a challenge to the industry and a challenge to marketers to really understand and embrace the phenomenal change that we're seeing. And it's easy to overestimate the pace but underestimate the extent of the change, as the saying goes. And we really think, as an agency and as a global group, it's really important that we embrace these changes. And so We're the Future was an attempt to really package that up.
If you work in marketing, you better start upping your game.
Because you haven't seen anything like us yet.
In just 10 years from now, we'll be buying and influencing buying
in ways that will confound you.
We won't just watch your ads.
We'll expect smart, tailored content based on our social graphs.
Tailored for me.
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 And me.
We want to interact with it as we watch it, not just with touch,
but with voice, with gesture,
with intent. You better embed everything that is featured with additional information, social APIs, and e-commerce functionality.
And we mean everything.
Everything. Everything.
So that was some of the kids with their kind of very nice, they all sound like very nice home counties children from the UK, don't they?
They certainly were. I think that one thing that we've been quite keen to do in our response to this is to really separate the ambition for the piece and the execution. And are there question marks over the execution? Very possibly and probably. But in terms of our intention, in terms of the ambition of that piece and why we did it and why we created it, we stand by that 100%. And if we're going to be an agency and a global group that is about anything, it's about having a point of view and being talked about and being provocative. And anyone in the network will stand up for that at any point.
See, my question is, you then created this website to discuss it afterwards. To me, that actually almost felt like some sort of admission that you'd got something wrong. And up to then, it had felt to me like the conversation was pretty robust, but hey, the agency stood for something. Here we are. This is what we're about. Like it or don't like it. Whereas this almost felt like a little bit of a retreat.
It was an amazing experience for us. It's so different when you talk to clients, when you talk to organizations about how you got to manage social media and the rights and the wrongs. It is so different when those spotlights, when those headlights are literally bearing down the road at you. And hours become minutes, you know, time becomes so critical, and you're making what become really quite high pressure decisions in a really short time frame. And did we get every decision right in terms of our response to that? Possibly not. But did we learn a lot in doing so? Absolutely. And do we stand by what we were saying? 100%.
Now, as regular readers of Mumbrella will be aware, we're organising our first conference in June, Mumbrella 360. Now, it's on a pretty ambitious scale and we're taking a few risks. Now, there are a few things, arguably the bravest things, that could actually definitely fail. Now, one of them is the Media Manifesto, which is being curated by PhD. Chris, tell me about the ambitions for the session.
The ambition for the session and for Media Manifesto at 360 is really to curate and have a session which isn't about us talking to the industry, which is very much about us curating and giving the industry an opportunity to really set an agenda for itself. We are witnessing unprecedented change. We are seeing huge challenges and changes and increasing pressures on resources and on bottom lines, with more to do by more people in more places more of the time. And obviously each agency will go about addressing those challenges in their own way and on their own terms. But we see a real opportunity to have a shared agenda, a shared manifesto, to go about how we tackle those. And it's a manifesto and agenda that will shape the conversations we have with each other as agencies, but also with media partners. And most importantly, with clients. I think that it's really important that as an industry, we can have this shared agenda, this shared ambition, this shared manifesto. So clients start hearing it, advertisers in this market and marketers start hearing this really joined up point of view. And it's really important, of course, that agencies go about then addressing that in their own way. But I think there's a real opportunity to start having joined-up conversations with clients and really start moving the industry forward as it needs to move.
What the outcome's going to be? What are you looking for?
What I'm looking for is some kind of real locked-down list of articles or list of agreements or lists of point of views that will align those conversations. If you look back to what Clue Train did quite a long time ago, Clue
Train. Now, for those who aren't familiar with the Clue Train manifesto.
So the Clue Train manifesto was a list of articles which set about an agenda and a set of beliefs about the internet and what the internet was and how the internet would change. I think the very first article is that markets are conversations. Incredibly prophetic observation that markets are conversations. An observation that came well before social media and the Twitter effect that we see now. So it was something that really shaped an agenda and really challenged people's thinking. And if we can do that for the media industry, and if the industry can do that for itself, then I think it would be an accomplishment, and it would be something that would give us a common language and a common agenda going forward.
Next, shake, rattle and roll at Fairfax.
We announced this week that joining Chris at Mumbrella 360 will be a debate between four of Fairfax Media's bosses on the death of newspapers. But even bigger news was a revolving door, getting a good workout with Financial Review editor Glenn Burge and CEO Michael Gill both moving on. Gill's leaving while Burge had been offered another job at Fairfax. It may have come as something as a surprise for Gill. Here's what he said when we asked him about rumours a few days before.
Now, Michael, is it kind of destabilising? Like, probably 2 or 3 weeks ago, Caroline Overington and The Australian reported Michael Gill's job has been offered to somebody within News Limited. He might not believe it, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, I found that...
when you read that sort of thing?
Well, they do that stuff all the time. And I think, you know, for some reason or other, they seem to find it acceptable to use their pages for their commercial, whatever you call that, commercial interest. But it seems to me that that proposition is pretty interesting, because the person they're talking about appears to have taken a number two job running The Australian, which loses $70 million a year, rather than take, on his account, a job that with a business that's pretty healthy.
How do you feel, though, when you read that? Do you pick up the phone and say, Greg, any truth in this? Or?
I don't have to. That's nonsense. Silly.
Brett Clegg was also announced as the new CEO of the Financial Review Group, coming over from The Australian. Tim, big moves?
Yeah, big moves indeed. Every now and then you get those sort of announcements that come and you know you've got to drop what you're doing and post it straight away. And it was kind of one of those, really. It was, I guess, given an added piquancy because... for the Mumbo Report, which is the video thing we do, we actually interviewed Michael Gill about the AFR paywall and that sort of thing. We'd recorded the interview less than a fortnight before. We actually, because there had been rumours about his job, we generally record the interviews in batches of four or five. We chose to put that one up first because, you know, to us there was some doubt whether he'd still be in his job, and we were glad we did, because sure enough, you know, within less than a week of that video appearing, he was gone. What was also interesting in the video though was that the first time he pointed to the man who was rumored to have been offered his job. So that was the first time that Greg Clegg's name was actually formally put in the frame. So he'd only been with the Australian for a year or so, and only, you know, less than 2 months deputy CEO of the Australian, which was a role given to him after Nick Leader left to go across to head up Google. So I think Nick Leader has now just started at Google, but doesn't yet have a profile. But we, you know, that will begin over the next few weeks, I'm sure. So I think probably what had happened was Fairfax had come after Brett Clegg. He'd then been given the promotion to the Australian because he was clearly rated by the guys at News Limited. Took that, and then Fairfax was obviously really keen to have him, so must have gone back a second time and persuaded him. So a big move. It saw Michael Gill, certainly the announcement said, retiring. Obviously, you know, when your job's been offered to someone else, that might be a choice that to a certain extent is forced upon you. And Glenn Burge, the editor of the AFR, not yet leaving Fairfax, but being offered an undisclosed job. I'm not sure if there is a specific one or not. Certainly reported elsewhere was the fact that Clegg had a clash of personalities or whatever with Burge, and that was one of the reasons he left Fairfax in the first place. So you can see why it might be untenable for the two of them to work together in a publisher-editor relationship. So that was one of the moves. And then the other things, I guess, announced since the last podcast were more sort of flowing naturally from the major restructure that's going on at Fairfax at the moment as they try and bring print and online together. So we've seen Jane Huxley become the digital publisher for Fairfax Metro.
She, of course, was the lady who announced the year of the mobile in a story recently.
Yeah. Of course, yes, that's right. Yes, which was one of the ones that we covered. She's actually from a kind of more a technology background than a journalism background, so a kind of interesting move. That'll be reporting into Jack Matthews as the new head of Metro. Formerly he was from the digital side, and Nick Kohler, head of the digital transactions unit. So that's like sort of the bits where Fairfax makes money not involving journalism, I suppose, is the best way of describing that.
Right. So, Chris, what should media buyers make of all this?
I think from our perspective, there's two things. The first of which is what we're clearly seeing is a business that is and has been under huge pressure. I mean, I think five CEOs in as many years, I think. So we're seeing a publishing business.
Yeah, not quite as many years, but not much longer
than that. So clearly a business under huge pressure. And what we're seeing are changes. And to be honest, from my perspective, I think there'd be more alarm bells if we weren't seeing changes to a business under so much pressure. There's clearly a need and opportunity to get that business right. The second observation really is that there's a huge opportunity in the conversations that organization has with media buyers in terms of just joining up the operations. I think that what's interesting is a lot of the titles that are now emerging. So digital publishing head of, digital transactions head of, there's clearly a swing towards making these digital conversations more to the fore, but also just hopefully joining them up. I think that it's been the case where we've been having, say, six different conversations with six different titles in the portfolio, and that's just inefficient. We've got less and less time to do it, and it's missing opportunities from them. So if the result of this is Fairfax having more joined up conversations and more integrated solutions for media agencies, then that'll be a great thing.
Well, a key announcement that's certainly not been made at the time of recording the podcast, but I'm guessing is fairly imminent, will be a national head of sales for the Metro titles, because at the moment you've got Sydney going their way, you've got The Age in Melbourne going its way. So that will be a really key role, and it'll be fascinating to see if that comes up within the company or externally.
What do you make of there's a lot of movement on the digital side with all these job title changes. What do you make of Fairfax's spearhead on the digital front?
I think like a lot of organizations, they've done a lot better over the last 12 months than they had previously. I think there's a lot of good things to be said about Fairfax and what they're doing. The challenge for them and any organization in the space is no one's got the model right, and no one knows what the online ad model is for these organizations. But you can't be left last. You've got to get in there, you've got to try your models, you've got to experiment. Other organizations are being quite public in how they're experimenting in this area with various pay-for models and subscription models and paywalls. So it's really important that they're out there testing models and experimenting to crack that business model, because that print cash cow is not going to last forever.
Next, Attack of the Moths, a warning from Earth Hour.
So Leo Burnett Sydney has created the Australian spot for the World Wildlife Foundation's Earth Hour, which is coming up this Saturday. It follows three Aussie blokes on a rural property where one of them chooses not to turn the barn light off and then gets attacked by the world's largest swarm of moths, because they are, of course, the only ones in Australia with a light on. Let's just hear a bit.
I'll get the light, would you, Shana?
Why?
It's Earth Hour.
It's just one light.
Every other light in Australia's off.
What's that?
Yeah, what is that?
Hey guys, found a shoe.
You want to get that light now, mate?
Yep.
Run! Ah! Ah! Ah!
Ah! So we didn't quite play you the whole clip because some of it is visual rather than audio, which is a good thing because it is a TV ad rather than a radio ad. Now, Robin, I guess philosophically you're the sort of person who likes things like Earth Hour, I suspect. What did you make of the strategy of using comedy to get the message across?
Yeah, I think it's really brave. Earth Hour is now in its fourth year, and every message up until then, including the global advertising, has been very emotive, green messaging. This is interesting because there's not a green message at all in the commercial. And I think comedically it works and it's funny. But yeah,
what,
I was chatting.
Think, yeah, I was going to say, what do you think Leo Burnett are thinking? What's the strategy behind it?
Well,
do you think?
I was speaking to Todd Sampson, who's CEO of Leo Burnett Sydney, yesterday, and he said sometimes seriousness gets in the way of serious issues. So I think now is the time for a change of tack. I think it's brave, but yeah, I think timely.
Chris, will you be switching off? Has the message persuaded you?
I hope so. I'm going to be out, and I rather hope that wherever I am, by that time on a Saturday night, choose to turn the lights off. I love this execution. I think it's great. I think it's smart. I think it's different. I think it's really important that WWF and the Earth Hour keep this message fresh. It's really important that they keep new ideas coming to the table each year. It can't feel like, oh yeah, it's that thing again. And I think from my perspective, there's a really, really interesting insight that sits at the heart of this, where the tagline is "Don't be the only one." And there's clearly this really smart observation that one of the challenges for Earth Hour is in many ways a microcosm of the climate debate, which is where individuals feel they don't make a difference. What difference can I make as an individual? I think that having that sign-off line, which is, you know, don't be the only one, and kind of activating that herd mentality is a really, really smart strategy.
I also think it's interesting it's comedy targeting apathy. A lot of people have, you know, it's fourth year now, people no longer care. It's no longer perhaps a thing to do. And that's why they've taken this approach.
Yeah, it's probably also worth remembering for those, you know, for those who don't. This originally was an idea that very much was a joint effort with WWF, but also, you know, co-parents were certainly Leo Burnett and arguably Fairfax as well. You know, those were the three driving things behind it, and obviously it's won lots of awards as a marketing idea as well. But I suppose, to me, I remember the first year felt like it was really big, this really new thing. You know, I remember sitting up on my balcony, kind of almost above Oxford Street in Sydney, as where I was living at the time, live blogging the event, and you know, popping downstairs a couple of times during it to see who was putting their lights off and who wasn't, and noticing that I think it was JC Decaux who hadn't got their billboards switched off, for instance, but seeing various individual, you know, the local bottler had candles and that sort of thing. So you know, it really felt something that people were throwing themselves into. But I almost wonder whether, as it's become global, Sydney's almost doesn't feel ownership of it in the same way.
I think Todd was saying again yesterday that it's one of the ideas that Leo Burnett has come up with that has legs, that has travelled. I think a little bit like Canon photo change. I think from that angle, it's also interesting. It's an idea that's born in Sydney and has been exported really well. And it's obviously it's travelled the world. It's interesting to see how that ad is played out globally. Will other countries also be looking to comedy as people get used to the message?
And it's worth noting there is a global ad as well, which has been made by Leo Burnett, Chicago, I think it was. That's which, right, funnily enough, was shot here in Australia, was shot at Fox Studios.
I think if there's an issue for Leo, it's that this idea is now being taken on and they're losing ownership of that. That's a brilliant problem to have. It's brilliant to see one of your kids, one of your ideas, grow up, leave the nest, and be taken on globally. I think it's a great and lovely problem for Leo's to have.
Well, next, lifting content and the Today Tonight, A Current Affair saga.
You have to love Today Tonight and A Current Affair battles. But this week, it got a little nastier, as Seven has accused its current affair rival of theft after it allegedly rebroadcast most of a segment from Today Tonight minutes after it had aired. The story was surrounding the much-debated video of a schoolyard fight. Rarely since internet publishing has taken off has the discussion of lifting content become more prominent. Tim, do you see more of it now online. Is it acceptable for TV?
I think the key phrase here is fair use. It's a sort of phrase that, you know, copyright lawyers use. The argument being that if you're using something for the purpose of review or news, you can use a small bit in order to tell your viewers, your listeners, your readers the story. So, for instance, in novels, you couldn't republish the novel, but you could republish a couple of key paragraphs as you're criticising them. Rather like when we watch the news and they do the sport highlights and you might see the goal on the news. You can't rebroadcast the whole match, but you can make fair use. So where we've gone closer and closer to the edge with Today Tonight and A Current Affair are two things. Attribution. We're seeing them lift clips from each other or lift stills from each other and hide the watermarks, you know, this message that appears on the screen, so, you know, saying either 9 or 7 or the name of the show, which gets closer and closer to the edge. And then we go a little bit further where they're lifting key quotes or, you know, key sort of even elements of interviews. So shortly before this latest escalation, we saw Today Tonight lift from A Current Affair several quotes from the bullying saga. This has all been this, you know, the two kids had the fight over bullying and it was videoed and went viral. So we saw Today Tonight lift some key elements of that, but just one of the kids involved talking. But the thing that kind of escalated it into new territory was Today Tonight broadcasting its own interview with one of the other proponents. It lasted about 8 minutes. And within minutes of that airing, A Current Affair rebroadcast about half of that interview, including the questions from the Today Tonight journalist. And that's the bit that felt like it was crossing the line. So since that all blew up, we've seen Seven make threats to go legal and have in fact served papers now. 9 of them counter-served their own papers. So we're going much further than it's gone before, and it all feels kind of grubby. But half of the problem is A Current Affair and Today Tonight, so competitive with each other. I think the attitude of a lot of people isn't so much sympathy Today Tonight as feeling they're both as bad as each other.
Seven, I was reading, have said that this incident is unprecedented. Are they right? It seems that as it has happened before, though.
Yeah, there've been some brilliantly pompous quotes on both sides. I would recommend anyone go to Umbrella and find the quotes from both the spokesmen, because they're both equally hilarious.
And the Jack the Ripper is a particular favourite.
Yes, yes, and the Churchillian is another word that that the 9 spokesmen use. And what I love about the 7 spokesmen and the 9 spokesmen. So 7 spokesmen is Simon Francis, 9's is David Hurley's. They know it's a game. I'm sure they know it's a game, and they enjoy playing the game.
There is a wonderful comment on the Umbrella site in the comments where someone says, I think it's Adam Paul is one of the commenters. He says it would be a joke to end all jokes if the last 10 years of A Current Affair in Today Tonight. It was a carefully scripted parody. But alas, there is this sense that it is now almost becoming parody. There is this sense that there's a game going on. They're playing it. And I think that the tragedy of this really is about a loss of credibility really in popular journalism. And I think that it's ironic that this is about a playground fight. And I think that it's in many ways the same thing kind of happening in the reporting of it. And I think that there's a bit of a tragedy of the commons here, that no one feels they can step away, because if the first person to step away could get Hamburg. So it's a bit of a prisoner's dilemma thing. But I think that if they both just stepped away from
that's
this...
That's a really good way of looking at it, because I've never thought about it as prisoner's dilemma. It's worth explaining what prisoner's dilemma is for people who don't know, which is effectively, right, oh God, I wish I hadn't started this day. But you have two prisoners who can't communicate with each other.
How many people in the podcast does it take to explain the prisoner's dilemma?
I'm going to have a crack at it and then tell me if I get it right. So you have two prisoners who can't communicate with each other. If they both keep quiet, they will both only get sentences of, say, 5 years. If one of them implicates the other one, then the one who gets implicated will get a sentence of 15 years. So what do you do? Is that about right?
I think that's very fair. It's a situation where both parties are rewarded for cooperation, but it relies on both parties trusting each other to cooperate. And if you don't trust each other, and if you do break the truce, then you've got a lot to gain.
And the other argument I make with TV programming is the whole battle of scheduling. You say your show is going to start at 7:30. You hold on until 7:40. You deliberately overrun in the hope that people don't overtune. Everyone does it to each other. Escalates and escalates. And the viewers lose out. And actually, the viewers move away from television. And that almost feels like they're in this race to the bottom. Neither one can give up because they'll give the other one advantage. But overall, television loses out.
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Viewers are the losers in this.
Do you think viewers actually notice that the watermark has been airbrushed out? I mean, some of it looks actually quite clumsy. But does it have the effect of turning viewers off that perhaps we think it does?
I mean, I think it'd be crazy if viewers didn't wonder why there was a huge blur across the middle of the screen while Kyle Sandland is leaving an airport. I think viewers would be crazy if they didn't wonder why that was going on. I think they know this is going on. I think that they know that there's this kind of, they're both doing it, that one's the same as each other. And I think that what you probably get is just, again, this loss of credibility, this like kind of like, you know, let them get on with it, which is a loss for the viewer and a tragedy really for what is an incredibly popular bit of television in Australia. That early evening popular journalism, it rates well, it's incredibly strong, and is, you know, and can be great television. And if we all just step back, if they all just step back and focused on creating great television, then we'd all be better off.
Next, 6 p.m. Sorry, make that 6:30 p.m. with George Negus.
Now, this is one that broke as we were diving in to record the podcast. It stays with the whole battle of news and current affairs. They are now, Channel 10 are now moving 6 p.m. with George Negus to 6:30. Since 10 made the decision to move The Simpsons and Neighbours to its new digital offering, 11, the 6 to 6:30 slot was filled with Negus's 6 p.m., followed by another half hour of news at 6:30. The change now means that from 5 p.m. right through to 6:30, there'll be 90 minutes of news, followed by Negus, and then the 7 p.m. project. Now, to me, it does make some sense, because 5 p.m. is always rated really well, the 5 p.m. news bulletin, but Negus at 6 was then falling off a cliff. It was up against 9 News, 7 News, which always rate really well. Now, it's going to be up against A Current Affair and Today Tonight, which might be somewhat different. What do you reckon, Chris?
I think it makes sense. I think it makes sense to if you look at what they want to put Negus up against in that slot, it makes sort of sense to focus on 90 minutes of news, let news go up against news, and then when you've got that more personality-led journalism, editorial-type news, give people a variety and go up against the right show. And I think that they're absolutely right to stick with Negus. I think that the danger will be a lot of tinkering now, and I think that let's get them in a slot they're happy with, and let's let them build an audience. I think less tinkering better from now on.
It seems to be a popular anchor, popular choice. What do you think it is about perhaps the show that hasn't worked, or perhaps that's not the case. What is it about Negus?
I think every show takes time to build. Every audience takes time to build. I think that we see it time after time at the moment that if a show isn't a hit within 2 weeks, then it's a disaster. And that's just not the case. A lot of shows take time to build. All shows take time to build.
And credit to Ten, they've been better than most at building shows.
Absolutely.
They did it with 7pm. I noticed that The Circle has been actually winning against Kerri-Anne Kennelly sometimes in mornings, which has taken more than a year, not even beginning to take on the morning show on 7 yet, but showing progress.
Yeah, a lot of viewing is very habitual, and it takes time to form. And networks have got to give audiences time to form those habits and form those relationships.
So there's a sense, possibly, this is a hasty change, that it's been made too soon?
I mean, it's not a radical change. I think that it makes sense to align it into that 6:30 slot. But I certainly think from now, if they can, they'd be well placed to give that show time and give that show some continuity in that slot.
Next, winners and losers at 7 and 9.
You're listening to the Mumbrella Cast. For more on all these stories, go to mumbrella.com.au. So while we're discussing the network battle, Seven introduced this week its much-anticipated winners and losers, hoping to follow in the footsteps of Pat to the Rafters. The move seemed to pay off, with it debuting on Wednesday with an audience of 1.6 million. Impressive. Unfortunately, the same can't be said for Nine's million-dollar drop, hosted by Eddie Maguire. Its premiere on Monday failed to draw in 1 million at an 8:30 time slot, despite the contestants taking home a wad of cash. Chris, did you watch the shows?
I did. I saw them. I saw all of Winners and Losers, and I saw selected highlights of Drop. Winners and Losers, I really enjoyed. I thought it was a great show. I thought it was well put together. I thought the script was good, and it just seemed like a really warm program, and it seemed to find an audience.
A lot of money was obviously spent on marketing. Do you think perhaps it's paid off?
Well, the I guess one of the proofs of marketing is also Million Dollar Drop had a lot of marketing behind it and didn't. So obviously Winners and Losers was given the benefit of the time slot. That was the key thing. Inheriting not only a great audience from the week before from people used to seeing Pack to the Rafters, but also inheriting a good audience from My Kitchen Rules, which aired immediately before it. So it was on a couple of winners, but it's very easy for the audience to switch off if they don't like it. You know, we saw it with Ben Elton, we've seen it with other things, and they stuck with it, you know, which does suggest that probably Seven have got a hit. But the other thing that fascinated me, and this is the first time I've ever seen this, was I was doing two things. I was watching the show and I was also watching the reaction on Twitter. And about 5 minutes before the show aired, every single Seven personality who's on Twitter all tweeted about it, all did different things in their own voices, but every single one. And it was obviously coordinated. Smart. First time I've ever seen that.
Yeah. And the target audience, presumably for Winners and Losers, is a younger demographic. Do you think, you know, this demographic presumably also is a bit more fickle? Do you think that this series has legs? Do you think it'll maintain that 1.6 million for the distance?
It'll be fascinating to see where episode 2 goes. I mean, a brilliant pilot in terms of the setup and the concept and that whole kind of reunion thing. And then that twist at the end with the lottery ticket. So a cracking pilot. I think there is a really big question mark now over, has it got legs? Will it sustain? And I hope it does. It's a cracking concept.
And the other piece of data I'd love to see is the breakdown between male-female, because it certainly felt that it was, whereas Rafters is more sort of maybe like family-focused, probably broad, my impression was that maybe Winners and Losers was a bit more female-focused. So, you know, I wonder whether the audience will skew that way, despite the fact that there were some raunchy scenes for the blokes too.
So you think, your impression is that perhaps this will gather a loyal following? Is it that sort of show?
Yeah, my instinct would be, wouldn't surprise me if it lost 100 or a couple of 100,000 initially and then kind of comes back, because, you know, things usually do after the marketing fades away. But, you know, if we say that million is the difference between a million viewers is the difference between a hit or a loss, then there's a lot of room for manoeuvre.
I'm going to go out. I think this will do well. I think we'll find an audience. I think we'll sustain it. I think this will be our Sex in the City.
Next, KFC's Cat Among the Pigeons.
So, a new ad standards board ruling involving the KFC ads, where the characters' alter egos persuade them to choose a KFC streetwise snack over a more boring but often healthier option. Let's hear first from the girl who's being persuaded not to eat crackers.
The pigeons called?
They want their lunch back. Come on, go get a new streetwise snack from KFC.
Delicious popcorn, chicken and gravy for only $1.95. Get smart, get streetwise.
So good.
And slightly more insanely, here's the clip of the man who is being persuaded by his alter ego that the way to win the woman of your dreams isn't to cook her dinner, but buy her KFC.
Mark.
Whoa.
Think for a second, Mark. You're punching above your weight as it is. Put the leftovers down. Grab your keys and go and get our lady friend the new streetwise lunch from KFC.
The double crunch burger has two crispy strips with that pepper mayo she loves, chips and a drink for just $5.95. Get smart, get streetwise.
So good.
So the complaints weren't so much about the ludicrousness of trying to woo someone with KFC, but the grounds that KFC is suggesting that its meals are an alternative to healthier options, which the Ad Standards Board decided wasn't the case at all. Robin, what do you make of that one?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure whether was it attack on healthy food. Or was it actually just bland food? I'm not sure. I mean, crackers obviously not particularly healthy either. And add it's not as if KFC is. I think the positioning of the ad is that, you know, it had the guitar rock in the background, and the new slogan "So Good" has a touch of devil about it anyway. I just think that's the style of the ad. What do you
Chris,
think,
Chris? Yeah, like legitimate way to market fast food.
I am against Quango's micromanaging advertisers. I am for advertisers having the freedom to put their point of view forward and express what they want to express. What viewers will make of KFC as a result of seeing this ad, KFC will have to live with.
Presumably, unfortunately, we haven't got much time to get into it today, but the argument against micromanaging or whatever, at least at the moment, the industry has self-regulation, so you have to have some sort of watchdog, I guess. Surely better than having the government regulate you directly.
Absolutely. You know, better than direct regulation, but at the same time, I think that it would be easy to give too much debate to these kind of decisions.
Yeah, the thing is, I have to say, I hate that KFC ad. The one with the girl with the... Yeah, the pigeons killed, they weren't living about. I just hate everything about it. It feels like, you know, someone's attempting to make a healthy choice. Someone who seems, you know, young and pressurable is being put under pressure. And I think the other problem I have with that ad is the idea and the strategy behind it is it's the people's alter egos talking to them. I don't think that's clear in that ad that it's her alter ego.
There is an executional challenge on that, which is they look too dissimilar. You don't get it's a girl talking to herself. Personally, do I like the ad? No. Professionally, do I support KFC's right to air it? Absolutely.
That is all we have time for today. Thank you to PhD Strategy Director and Mumbrella 360 presenter Chris Stevenson.
My pleasure, and hello to Jason Isaacs.
And my co-host Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
Production was by Alice Terlikovsky. Recorded at the studios of CBS Interactive, that was the Mumbrella Cast. And I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.